This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. August 9th will mark 39 years since President Richard Nixon resigned from office in the wake of the Watergate scandal. It was a turning point in American political culture, one that forever changed the way we viewed the executive branch. For Raleigh attorney Gene Boyce, it's also a part of his personal history. He spent 4 months as an assistant majority counsel on the Watergate committee. He helped investigate the circumstances surrounding the 1972 break-in at the Watergate offices in Washington, D.C., and it was his investigative team that discovered the tapes of presidential phone conversations that eventually led to the end of the Nixon presidency. And Gene Boyce joins us now in our studio. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the Watergate hearings in the first place.
It is an amazing story of circumstances that invaded my life that started right here in Raleigh in June of 1972. That was a month, the very month, the June 17th, when the burglars from the Republican committee to reelect the president, called CREEP by the Democrats, broke into the Watergate offices of the Democratic National Committee for the third time and got caught. It made some news at the time, but it was not huge, and that's when Woodard and Bernstein, the Washington Post, got onto it. It made a little bit of news, but they slowly connected the people involved to the official party group, and subsequently, not only that, later on to the White House. And I was in Raleigh minding my own business and raising college tuition for my children. And a friend of mine, Ike Andrews, who later became a congressman, was in the legislature, and he came into the office one day and said, "Gene, I'm going to run for Congress." And I congratulated him, and he said, "I need your help. I want you to be my campaign manager." I balked at first, but he was such a good friend. But he mainly said, "I just need you because more voters in Wake County than any other place, and you've got a Raleigh address." That's the absolute truth.
Qualified you as campaign manager.
I'm qualified. Well, I was glad to do it for him. He was such a wonderful man. He died a couple of years ago, but he was a great guy and a close friend. So I got into it, and I'll tell the story as quickly as I can. We won the race against a gentleman who is now a good friend of mine. Jack Hawk was a Republican candidate. I was on the Democrat side at the time, helping Ike. We won by 800 votes in Durham County. When the election vote came out, the Republicans contested it. They said we won by 800 votes, which was a pretty narrow margin, and the Republican opponent said there was fraud in Durham County. Well, that was not an unusual accusation. Excuse me, Durham County. But that's how it was. And they brought suit, and it went to court. And being involved, a trial attorney, and it was before a Republican judge. So it was a little interesting encounter, but Ike said I had to be his lawyer, too. That's circumstance number three. I was, and we went into court, and it dragged on a little bit, but on December the 27th, Judge Dupree's office called and said that he was ruling in our favor and that Ike was going to be sworn in. I thought that was the end of it. Circumstance number four, I think it was, Ike said, "Gene, you got to go with me to Washington." I said, "No, you were elected, not me." He said, "No, I need you to help me set up my staff." He was in a bind because he only had 6 days before he was going to be sworn in, so I went to Washington with him to help him set up his staff and then come back home to Raleigh where I belong. I went to Raleigh, helped him set up the staff, began in January is when the burglars were being tried. This trial started, I think, January the 7th. So there was a lot of activity in Washington, a lot of interest in what was going on. And in Washington, the routine is cocktail parties by lobbyists, three a night. And I would go to those parties with Ike and kept running into Senator Ervin and Rufus Edmiston. And Senator Ervin didn't go to many cocktail parties, but Rufus has not missed one in his life, and he knows I say that. But he kept telling me about the committee. They set up the Watergate Committee. They established it in January of 1973. 40
and, of course,
years
you talked about Sam Ervin, who was then chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which would oversee the Senate Judiciary Committee and, of course, the North Carolina Democratic Senate.
Right, he was ahead of it. It was actually under the Separation of Powers Committee, and Rufus was his chief counsel. So that evolved into the 1972 committee to investigate the campaign, political campaign activities of 1973 was the official name of the committee, but it was to investigate the facts and the ethics of what had gone on. The few of the connections were beginning to come out. One of the burglars had turned state's evidence. They say he'd written a secret letter to Judge Sirica and told him the problem went higher up than just the burglars. There were five burglars that broke in, and there was an FBI agent, a retired FBI and retired CIA guys over in the hotel were keeping a lookout, supposedly. The other circumstance there was they had microphones, electronic equipment, and they were to tell the burglars if police showed up. Well, when the night watchman found the second piece of tape, he notified the police, but a police car didn't come.
So you're talking about the duct tape they used to keep the door open, because they'd already gotten locked in once, right?
They'd gotten locked in once. They went back in because the bugs on the phone from the second break-in did not work. We're not working. So that was one reason they went in. But the circumstance was there was no marked police car in the vicinity. An unmarked police car pulled up to the building. So Hunt and Liddy, the FBI, CIA guys, didn't pay any attention to it. The guys that got out of it were not uniformed officers. They were undercover, plain clothes, in an unmarked car. Another circumstance, had it not been for the duct tape, had it not been for the unmarked police car, the burglars may not have been caught. Nixon may have served out his term. So that
night watchman is the guy who figured out on the second round of that tape, better call somebody. Cops coming in the unmarked car.
Right.
And that's the beginning of the end.
Yes.
So now, but you're there and you're at the cocktail, but we left you at the cocktail party with with Rufus and,
well,
and Irvin.
They were having problems that related to trial type work. And the lawyers that they had already hired had not had trial experience, and that's all I've ever done before and since, except for this political experience. And they were having trouble with the court reporting system, and I set that up for them. So they had rotating court reporters. One would take the testimony for an hour, and then he or she would go out and type it up. The other one would replace them, and we could have the transcript of testimony on the senator's desk for the morning by 5 o'clock that afternoon. Right. For the afternoon session, have it on their desk by the next morning. So I knew about that sort of stuff. And also the evidence over in the criminal court, they wanted to get that, and the lawyers ahead didn't know a whole lot about a chain of custody of evidence. So I worked that out for them. But probably the most interesting job I had was all of the information from the detectives. Our investigators was coming in on 3x5 index cards, and the index cards within 30 days was piling up, and it was a very poor system. And here's another circumstance. I was eating lunch with some friends at the Library of Congress that I'd met when I was with Congressman Andrews the month before, and I was telling them, I'm having a hard time with these index cards. They said, well, we're revamping the Library of Congress, our card catalog system, which when I went to school, maybe you, if you're old enough, they had a card catalog system to find a book.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, we're putting our card catalog on a computer. And I said, on a what? This was 1973. I didn't know what they were talking about. They said, yeah, we have our workers input the data, the name of the book, the name of the publisher, the name of the author, the date of publication, the principal characters. And it sounded like exactly what I was getting with investigative reports on 3x5 index cards. And I knew the ultimate result of every congressional committee is a final report to the full Congress so they can change the laws or do what they need to do legally to correct a situation. And so I said, what's that computer thing? I said, well, our people come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, input data. I didn't know what the term meant. I said, then they leave at 4, and then another team comes in at 4 and works to midnight. We want to get it done because they have umpteen million books in the Library of Congress. Said, we just feel like we got to get it done. And I said, well, what do you do with that computer thing from midnight to 8 next morning? They said, oh, nothing. I said, well, would you loan that to the Watergate Committee? And people at that time were becoming very interested in what was going on and helping out or doing what they could, but very focused. They said, oh, sure, yeah, they worked it out. So from that point on, all of our investigative data went into a computer, and I said, show me the computer. And I went over to the Library of Congress. They took me down a hall. There was this room, not much bigger than this, and had a bunch of black boxes on three walls with lights blinking. I said, this is a computer. When I tell people about it, I say, I told those Library of Congress people, why don't you people get a laptop? This is ridiculous.
You did not. Who did? This is sort of fascinating to think about this because, of course, the committees are crawling with lawyers, but as you suggest, none of them with trial experience, and you not having any computer experience, and now you're going to put all this data on. So who did the input? Who did the data entry?
We had to hire ladies, mostly women, yeah, data input at that time, that took our investigators' reports that were coming in from the field all over the United States, some in South America, overseas, from everywhere, and they would input the data from the 3x index cards my investigators would report on, and they would input it into the computer.
We will find out what happened when this went from a third-rate burglary to the scandal that brought down the Nixon administration with an attorney who was on the staff, a Raleigh attorney, Gene Boyce, talk about his role in the investigation of Watergate. And that conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking with Raleigh attorney Gene Boyce about his role in the Watergate investigation as we come up on the 39th anniversary of the break-in. So it starts out as a break-in. This is a criminal investigation. How quickly did you realize that this was going to be much more than a third-rate burglary?
I think probably when I was interviewed for the job after Rufus had recommended me, Sam Dash was the chief counsel. He's a professor over at the law school, and Senator Irvin had named him chief counsel. And he invited me to lunch to interview me to see whether he thought I was qualified. But I remember very well his question at the luncheon was, Gene, would you have any problem if our investigation goes all the way to the top? And that rang a bell, and I said, no, Sam, I'll follow the truth wherever it goes. I remember I said that because I've always felt that way. Wherever the truth leads, I'll go after it. And that gave me the hint that they knew more than was being publicized at the time. So they knew there was a possibility of a cover-up story coming forward, and that gave me the hint of what was about to come.
I think I said this is the 39th anniversary of the break-in, but of course this is actually the 39th anniversary of Nixon's resignation.
Yeah. Well, it's really the break-in was in 40th anniversary was last year, 2012.
Yeah. Right.
2013 is the anniversary of my discovery of the Watergate tapes, and really next year, 2014, is the 40th anniversary of 1974.
Right, the actual resignation. Well, let's talk about the tapes, because that became the big breakthrough in this case. Tell us about that and how your team discovered these tapes. They'd been rolling for quite a few years in the White House.
Yes, after I finished my preliminary work setting up the court reporting system and doing the computer setup and getting the investigative system worked out and getting Judge Sirica to let me take the burglary equipment over to our committee to display it on television. At that point, they needed another investigator. They had the three lawyers they'd hired had three investigative teams. They decided they needed a fourth one and asked me to stay on to be the fourth. And I did, and assigned to my team was the Republican Minority Counsel, Don Sanders, a retired FBI agent. The teams consisted of Majority Counsel, that was me, a Minority Counsel in my group was Don, an investigator who was Scott Armstrong, who later became famous with co-authoring the book The Brethren about the U.S. Supreme Court. He was the investigator. And then we had a court reporter, a stenographer back then. She did it all by hand. And that was the system. It was quite – here's another circumstance. It's quite by accident that my list of people to interview was one Alexander Butterfield, who had preceded John Dean. He was the chief of staff over in the Oval Office. He was then the head of the FAA, but he was involved during the period of time in question, and so he was on my list to talk to. And But preceding that, we had interviewed John Dean, and I had done some other things that led to the ultimate discovery of the tape pretty much directly. The first thing was John Dean had made the comment, just an aside, that I was talking with Nixon one day in the Oval Office, and he was asking me yes and no questions. And Dean, being a lawyer, felt, as he would, I felt like I was being cross-examined, and I was afraid I was being taped because all he was doing was asking me yes and no questions. He wouldn't let me talk, just yes, no, yes, no. And that kind of raised a little suspicion of maybe a Radio Shack tape recorder hidden in a drawer or something. But the major thing was I had subpoenaed from the present counsel over at the White House, Fred Buzhardt, a lawyer from South Carolina, very, very good lawyer, Nixon's calendar that showed his appointments, who he met with going back 18 months, who he met with, how long it lasted, who came in, who came out. I just wanted to know what was going on. The other thing I had already subpoenaed was Nixon's his own daily reports. What did he do? How did he keep? He didn't keep a diary like Ronald Reagan kept a daily diary. Mm-hmm. And Nixon did not keep notes. So he got the morning news reports, and in the margin of the news reports, I learned from getting those documents, he would just simply write in the initials of his assistant who he wanted to follow up on that particular daily story. That was all the writing he did. So that made you wonder, too. But when the calendar came over from the White House going back 18 months, it had the information I was looking for, but it also had a summary on the bottom of each calendar date, a summary of what it was about. And so that raised the question in an ordinary mind, well, how did they go back 18 months and know what was on there? Because if nobody was keeping a record of it. And so those little hints led us, when we got Butterfield over there on Friday the 13th, the day after my birthday, I was headed home to go to a birthday party, but I had to stay in Washington that Friday afternoon, late Friday afternoon. And Armstrong went through, the investigator who's supposed to ask the most questions, went through 3 hours and 15 minutes and never touched on the subject of the tapes. This procedure was investigator first, minority counsel second, and then I was supposed to clean up. Well, Don and I talked about the taping, and Don asked a few questions, and then, contrary to what Time Magazine reported, it was not a throwaway question. It was intentional. Don said, Mr. Butterfield, is anything what we've been hearing about a taping system in the Oval Office? That's all we thought about. That was the only quote, question, close quote, ask. It was just a suggestion of, is anything, you know, about it. Butterfield opened up because he told us he was in his conference that morning with the White House attorney, Buzhardt. They thought that we might get into that. And he said, I was told that I had to answer truthfully, so I'm going to have to tell. And of course, that was right. He had to tell the truth. He was under oath. And so he told the whole story. And it was not just taping system in the Oval Office. It was a taping system in the Oval Office, the executive building, president's office in the executive building, one in the cabinet room. And the frightening thing was, he said, and there was a taping system. It was a taping locator system. They'd know where the president was at any given time with a flashing light on a board. But only seven people knew there was a taping system. And he said at the Aspen cabin at Camp David, that frightened me at the time because about 4 months before then, the premier of the Soviet Union had come to the United States. Situation had warmed up a little bit with Russia and had stayed in the Aspen cabin. And my first reaction was, oh, my Lord, World War III, we have secretly taped the premier of the Soviet Union.
And it's not a secret anymore.
It's not a secret anymore. But I asked that question, and Butterfield said, no, when we have visitors in the cabin, if anybody other than the president is there, we cut it off. And yeah, I hope the lawyer,
of course, these systems,
telling the truth.
Nixon didn't put the system in. It had predated him. It was something he inherited.
No. There's been talk that Kennedy had a system and that Johnson had a system, but there's never been any proof that I ever saw. There was not one in there, and Nixon did put it in about 18 months before it was discovered.
Well, Nixon, we've heard some of the phone conversations that Johnson had, so we know that his phone conversations were taped, and I've actually heard those tapes.
Yeah, there was some taping going on, but it never exploded into a... situation like this.
So how important, you know, it's interesting now because this data is coming in. And, of course, one of the more fascinating things about the Watergate case was how quickly it proliferated into other cases and grew into, you know, cases that went far beyond the initial burglary, the break-in, without a computer system. So let's go back to that. There would have been pretty difficult to keep track of all this, it seems to me.
It evolved tremendously on these days that we're talking about in 72, 73, and on into 74. It went into court, went to the U.S. Supreme Court, because Nixon released some of the tapes but didn't release them all.
Right.
Rosemary Woods, the secretary, you remember the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. She demonstrated how her foot went to the wrong place. It was further away than her leg would really reach. And so it was a continuing series of very important events.
What was your first thought when you heard that there was a taping system?
I was not that surprised because we suspected it, but the extent of it was a shock. And to have one at Camp David was a real shock.
Well, and I understand that at one point you thought, well, you know, this might even demonstrate his innocence.
My reaction was that clever devil. He has recorded it, and what he's been saying is the truth. I usually give people at first impression that they're telling the truth, and I accorded him that what turned out to be erroneous, that he was telling the truth, that he didn't know. And that he hadn't tried to cover it up. But the way it evolved and his hiding those tapes, it was very shortly thereafter that I said, this thing's going to go all the way.
Right. I mean, Siri, if he knew he had it and that would prove him innocent, then he probably would have told us about it a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A long time ago.
So you find them. How was that crucial? Do you think there would have been enough evidence without those tapes to bring down the presidency?
I don't think so. The tapes, if you have ever heard or read the transcripts of them, they're extremely revealing. And it's more of a disclosure of them covering up what the truth was about the break-in. Whether Nixon engineered it originally or had his hand in it real deep in early June of 1972, I doubt it. His big mistake was the mistake that so many make about the cover-up is always is not as bad as the crime, but it'll get you into just as much trouble as if you did.
Well, tell us about the fallout from that and the immediate aftermath, the kind of changes that took place in Washington and the legal profession.
Yeah, it had a great impact on things because so many of the individuals involved, I think some 42 people, men mainly, I don't believe there were any women at all, were convicted, and most of them served some time in jail. But the outstanding point that I've uncovered since then, or in following up on it, 20 of the group of Nixon people were attorneys, and they were involved in a lot of illegal activity. There were some on the campaign, the campaign committee. There were some on the finance committee. And, of course, there were some in the White House. And there were 20 who were involved and who were actually convicted and whose lives and careers were shattered by their lack of respect for the ethics of the profession. And it evolved later on in the 80s and 90s. It made some changes on the national basis as well as the state basis on legal code of responsibility, code of ethics for lawyers, to explain to young and old lawyers who their client really is. When they work for an entity, they represent the entity. They're not supposed to engage in cover-up or criminal activity. They're supposed to either report it or get out of it, stay away from it. And those rules of ethics I think for the most part they're being obeyed by the attorneys.
Well, weren't they in place anyway? I mean, to what extent was there any ambiguity about whether or not you could follow your client's directive, the president's directive, to help you with what is fundamentally an illegal act to cover up an illegal activity?
I think the thought was more it was an open question. It was a question of confusion. Nobody had really ever pinpointed that, and that was one of the value of the Watergate exposure, that it taught lawyers a lesson for the future. The simple rules back then were do the right thing. If they'd stopped long enough, if John Dean had stopped long enough, he told the president there's a cancer growing on you. He warned him, but unfortunately he didn't come forward, or he didn't get on the bus and go back to California and stay out of it. I think they know better now.
Of course, it was traumatic for the nation to go through this whole exercise, to watch a president resign in disgrace, to see the office itself so scandalized. And it was a difficult moment for all of us. For you as an attorney and someone who is now involved in this activity, coming from Raleigh as you did, almost by accident getting involved, what were your personal feelings going through this?
I felt Nixon had won. Up until that time, until Reagan came, had won by the greatest majority ever, other than George Washington, who got all the Electoral College. But he had, 520 electoral votes for Nixon to 17 for McGovern. McGovern carried only the state of Massachusetts and the District of Columbia. Nixon was riding high. He was very popular. He took North Carolina. He took the nation by storm. People at that time really respected him. It was such a terrible thing for someone who had obviously worked hard and been through some rough political things in advance, had gotten to that level, for him to ruin his own life and his career. It was just unbelievable and devastating.
I wonder about the lessons we've learned since. We see a lot of accusations now against the Obama administration, a cover-up, at least in terms of policy. No, nothing illegal about what happened in Benghazi, but did the administration try to cover up what happened, or was it the CIA saying, no, this is actually classified information. We couldn't tell you that there were in fact, extremist groups involved. Certainly not the level of illegal activity, but a cover-up nonetheless. IRS scandal, FBI, you know, getting a – well, it was illegal. It was a warrant that a judge signed. But again, a Fox reporter trying to get the emails of a Fox reporter. Are these the same things, and are we sort of seeing a recurrence of this?
Yes, there's a lot of similarities along those lines. And the simple response, so if you make a mistake, the best thing you can do is admit it as quick as you can. And try to correct it. Don't try to get out of it. Don't try to cover it up. Go ahead and be truthful and honest and forthcoming about it, and it'll do you a whole lot more good than it will. Nixon had said, the first I learned about all of this thing about the, he called it third-rate burglar, was from news reports that I think most people learned about it. It's what Obama said and Nixon had said. I first learned from news reports. And Nixon said, the comments I made during this period in 1972 by my press secretary on my behalf were based on the information provided to us at the time we made those comments. Here, 40 years later, President Obama said about Benghazi, keep in mind, by the way, these so-called talking points that were prepared pretty much matched the assessments that I was receiving at that time from his staff people. Nixon said, and had we not had that kind of security and that kind of secrecy that allowed for that kind of exchange, it is essential. He went on to say, but then Obama said, leaks relating to national security can put people at risk. So they were comparing the danger and the interest of having a secure government where everything doesn't come out, that some things are, I guess you say, covered up, but some information has to be withheld from the public for security reasons. And Obama said leaks related to national security can put people at risk, and that is true. But leaks about illegal activity of our own people need to come out. That affects not only national security, but the good of the nation.
Of course, it is interesting. Those Fox reporter emails were gotten legally by a federal warrant, and a federal judge did sign that. So there was a due process of law that that they followed in that case. And in the Benghazi case, I guess the emails in many cases demonstrate that, in fact, the CIA and the State Department did have a conflict about how they assessed this. And the CIA decided to withdraw the statement because it was based on classified information. They didn't want to leak that. So in this case, maybe the emails were exculpatory, as you lawyer folk like to say.
That's true. The big thing about Benghazi was trying to blame it on a videotape. I watched that videotape. That was the silliest, dumbest, stupidest videotape I think I've ever seen. It was I'm sure it was offensive to the religion and the religious aspect of it, but it was pitiful. It was poor.
Gene Boyce, what a pleasure. So good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Gene Boyce, a Raleigh attorney, part of the committee that investigated the Watergate break-in and the subsequent scandal during the administration of President Richard Nixon. There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.